Welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and this week I am joined by someone who fell in love with food at a very young age. Coupled with an aptitude and passion for science, she wanted to make a difference in how we eat. And after a short and not entirely pleasant detour into the world of modelling, that's exactly what she's done. Boasting followers in their millions across Instagram and TikTok, her followers love her no-nonsense healthy recipes and advice on nutrition. Today, we talk about how she built her brand and some of the stumbles on the way to success.
Unfortunately, I just couldn't find the right staff and ended up having a little bit of disagreement with my business partners. They got me at a time when I think I had about 1,000 followers, and my husband was there being like, oh, you need to get behind the camera, like, because you're so great and you need to be the face of this brand. And I remember turning around to my business partners and they said, no one cares about what you have to say. Like, no one cares about you.
Yes, my guest is, of course, the brilliant Emily English. That's all on this week's episode of The Savoy Originals. Emily English, hello. Welcome to The Savoy.
Thank
Cheers.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
Oh, there we go. That was a nice
I'm going to have a sip.
Yeah, go for it. Go for your life. Welcome. Mm. The Savoy Originals is supported by Laurent Perrier, one of the great innovators of the Champagne region. And as Emily takes her place in our penthouse suite here at the Savoy, we are toasting her success with a bottle of Laurent Perrier Heritage, their latest release, something you can do too here at the Savoy. But let's get back to room 317.
So I came from a massive family, and my parents basically had me and my older brother. We had this lovely idyllic family of four, and then they were like, oh, let's just have one more. Mum fell pregnant with twins. And then my little sister came out a year later. So she had three kids under the age of three when I was like 8 years old. So I suddenly fell into the kind of bigger sister responsibility camp of being able to help and make dinner. And I think I'm always conscious with the recipes that I come up with now. They feel accessible and achievable and realistic. And it's probably one of the reasons why they do so well with so many different people from all walks of life.
What was home life like growing up in Bedford? Was it chaotic? Was it quite well organised?
It was absolute chaos. I mean, it still is chaos now, even though we've all kind of grown up. I speak to my parents about this now. I think I had to grow up very quickly. It was up to me to make sure that my school clothes were washed and cleaned. It was up to me to pack my school bag, to do my homework. Like, I didn't have someone who was able to kind of constantly nurture me and help me where, like, kind of lead me to where I was meant to go. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why now I'm so hyper independent, I'm so driven, I'm so strong, and I feel like if there's something in front of me, I find a solution, I don't see it as a problem, and that reflects in my work.
What were the signature Emily English dishes age 10 when you were cooking for the family?
I could make, and I actually made it yesterday, it's so funny, the best chili con carne. But it's a fridge-raised chili con carne. So it's like whatever knobbly bit of like half-eaten courgette you got in the bottom of the fridge, you chop it up and you stick it in there. We didn't have loads of money, so we had to cook, but we made amazing food, and my mum was the best at literally making something out of nothing. So this chili con carne literally had like 8 types of veg in, not necessarily for the health purposes, but for bulking the meat out. So my mum would have a 500-gram pack of mince to feed 7 people, and it worked. So the chili con carne was an absolute signature. Pretty much anything mince based.
Were you ever told, make sure you eat the mince first, that's the most expensive bit, if you leave anything, leave the veg? I was told that when we had fish and chips as a kid, it was like, if you're going to leave anything, leave the chips, eat the fish, that's where the money went.
Leaving something? No, we weren't allowed to leave anything. You didn't get off the dinner table until you clean your plate. And that's, I mean, my nan was definitely someone who was like that too. And even now, like, I have quite a few chef friends in restaurants, and they love to feed us whenever we go. I leave so stuffed every time because I cannot leave a thing. But I'm very lucky that my husband basically is like the human dustbin, so he can definitely pick up the team if I'm given a bit of slack.
You mentioned your grand. You've described growing up as being in a family of chefs and cooks who loved food. Who was the best cook growing up?
Chef Granny. Right. Oh, she still is. She's just iconic. She used to work as a head chef in a restaurant called Flitwick Manor. And then she found this beautiful, like, listed thatched cottage out in the countryside called Cornfields, looking over the cornfields. The types of food that she did was just food that put a smile on people's faces. It was like modern British with classical French techniques. So she used to do, and I still make them for Christmas, Stilton bacon walnut fritters. So you dice shallot, you grate Stilton, you have lovely toasted walnuts, you roll them into a ball, you wrap them in bacon, and then you breadcrumb them with like a stale granary breadcrumb mix from the bread that she used to make and have left over. And then you deep fry them, and then you serve them on a bed of rocket with a cranberry and port sauce. And if she ever took them off the menu, the customers would be furious. But I remember the first time like I ever tasted those like vividly. And I remember the moments of like going into my granny's restaurant and sitting down and her cooking for us and the joy that that food and that moment gave us. And it's why now like restaurants and hospitality is my soft spot. They have my heart and I just don't think the world would be the same without them.
I love the way you just delivered that Stilton fritters recipe. It was like watching one of your Instagram reels live. But no, you do it with such efficiency. Like I think I used the word no nonsense earlier to describe the way you deliver it. So it's a real skill to get that much information across in such a short amount of time.
Thank goodness that I have WhatsApp messages to listen to at 2x speed because my brain does run quite quickly.
So you actually worked at Cornfields Restaurant, didn't you, for a while, both in the kitchen and waiting tables. What effect did actually working in that commercial food environment have on you? Sort of seeing customers' eyes either, I mean, light up or potentially look disappointed when you are serving them food because maybe their guest has got something that's a lot better.
Yeah. Do you know what? Every single thing that I've always done with work, like I've always wanted to try and do the best possible job that I could. And when I was working in, even if it was like back of house, I'd want to make sure that every single breaded brie was perfect. I'd want to make sure that my granny turned around and said, oh, wow, Em, you're so quick. Great job. If I was serving guests, I'd almost like look for the validation at the end of the meal being like, you were great. Fantastic. And it's funny because I think so you're either like a giver or you like to kind of receive. And I'm definitely someone who loves to give in my life. I like to give with kind of what I believe in and my emotion and my care. And I want people to have a good time as a consequence of what I can offer. Mm. And that was, looking back now, I was exactly the same person.
But I guess that it's a kind of slippery slope because you don't just want to be doing it for validation. You want to be doing it because it makes you happy. And if the validation isn't there, perhaps people are just like, assume this is what you do. Mm. You still have to enjoy it.
100%. And I think sometimes validation you should see as a consequence or a side effect of doing something that you love. And I think the biggest issue or where it can get maybe a little bit toxic is where people do something that they're not actually being present or enjoying anymore just to seek that validation. And I think I'm very lucky with my life. I get messages from people every single day being like, made your chicken lasagna last night, best thing ever, all my family loved it. And that for me is really like soul warming validation because it's coming from a place of something that I genuinely love doing.
It sounds like mealtimes, you were just talking about what they were like in the English household. How would you describe them? Because they sound like, reading around them, they sound like something of an event, like a real focal point for the family.
I'm feral. Honestly,
feral.
Even now, it's like survival of the fittest. If you don't, so my mum always just put everything like down in family style platters or big bowls. Like we didn't like portion things up. It was like, reach for the fork, push your brother out the way, like, oh, who's going to get the last bit of cheese? So yeah, it was always a little bit desperate. And if we ever, so whenever mum did the food shop and like the multi-pack of crisps would come, I'd try and like hoard away my favourite flavours because otherwise I'd just get eaten. And the only thing left at the end is like ready salted and you're like, damn.
Was there anything that was placed on the table that you haven't eaten for a while? Because foods do tend to wane in popularity. I mean, I remember as a kid having liver and fried onions a lot up in Leeds, and I haven't seen that on a menu or in front of me for many, many years. Is there anything that you haven't had that you had as a child for a while? Or?
Do you know what? I don't think we eat sausages and mash enough. Like, I know it's probably not very glamorous and it's like, oh, here's the nutritionist talking about sausages and mash. But my favourite combination used to be pork and apple sausages. And then mum used to like cook them in the oven and hopefully forget about them for a little bit. So they caramelise all on the outside, but you're like sticky and then gorgeous in the middle. Mm. Super buttery mash with loads of extra like Lurpak on. And she used to put the tub of Lurpak on the table and always used to get an extra dollop. And then she'd just do like loads of greens. So like kale, spinach, cabbage, and maybe some carrots and stuff. And that was it, with really good gravy, like an onion gravy that she'd make homemade. And it was so good and so nostalgic. And I think food has this ability to like unlock so many feelings and emotions for us. And I always say vitamin joy is just as an essential nutrient as your vitamin C and your vitamin D. And it doesn't have to be this kind of like slick, idealistic like version of health and nutrition for it to really be nourishing and soul nourishing. So yeah, sausages and mash is out there for me.
I guess it's a kind of food as well that there are certain foods that elicit an emotional response in terms of the comfort factor, and I guess that can't be underestimated as well. There's nutrition, there's health, there's a variety, and there's, you know, putting good stuff in your body. But I think there is an element to eating food that nurtures the soul, if you will.
So often when people decide, okay, look, I want to be healthier, and like people turn around and be like, oh, I'm gonna start being better, what they often do is they take away all of their identity in their food that they eat, and they suddenly eat as if they were a different person without the same loves and culture and things that they like to eat on a Friday. And I think this is where so much of it has gone wrong. It's because people feel like they need to change so much about what they do with food, when it's like, we don't eat nutrients, we eat food. We sit down with a plate of something with people that we love, and that should be the core of everything. And that's the core of all the recipes that I write. And another recipe that my mum used to do was, she used to call it salmon in puff, and it came from my granny as well. Basically salmon en croûte, but an easy version. And it's the one thing that whenever I used to finish an exam or come back from university, my mum was like, oh, what do you want to eat? And it was always salmon and puff. And it's, yeah, it's puff pastry, and it's got this like lovely, like creamy, like leek sauce. And I put my little twist on it in the book, of course, but it's still like a great source of protein, lovely healthy fats, fiber diversity. But you'll have some people in the health community who look at that and be like, oh, you shouldn't eat that, or that's bad for you. And it would fall into that black and white health food category.
Yeah, I'm a little guilty of that. Like, I was like, right, big change coming, going to stop eating carbs. So cut out like pasta, bread, potatoes, right, all of it just gone.
Champagne? Because,
yeah, the champagne. No, of course not champagne. I didn't cut that out. I'm not crazy. But I, you know, you'd see me with my face pressed up against the window of Pizza Express, like just like longing for anything with some sustenance, some carbs. I was desperate for carbs, because I think we're all guilty of, like you say, just sharp rights instead of gradual change.
But you're not guilty. It's the way that we've been taught, and it's the way that we've been fed information about health and nutrition for so many years. Like, it doesn't feel normal. It doesn't feel like a normal way of living. But I hopefully am here to show people it's like you can actually feel very happy, very confident, very comfortable in your health and your body by doing something that doesn't feel alien to you. Sustainability is key. And if you want to make an actual difference to your health, you need to make changes that you know you can stick to for the rest of your life. And that can sound a bit extreme, but it's not extreme, because the changes and the choices that you make aren't actually that scary, and they're not intimidating. And I think that's why, again, like my recipe books have done so well. It's because people open it and they're like, okay, I'm having this massive high protein hit with all these lovely plants and this variety, but I'm eating it in lasagna form. I can do this. And it's that kind of realization and breaking down those like misconceptions around health and nutrition that is so key.
I do think that's one of your great strengths, is the fact that I went vegan for a while, and I bought a lot of vegan cookbooks, and I swear to God, there were chefs listing ingredients that at 46 years old I've never heard of. I'm like, what even is that?
I remember when I first went on a health kick, or I got into the health space, I went to Holland & Barrett, and I think I spent like £50 on like goji berries. And do you remember when they became the hype? And everyone's like, wow, goji berries. He's like, this is the secret of health. And I'm like, no, you can just literally eat raspberries. Raspberries, one of the highest fiber fruits. They're fantastic for you, full of antioxidants. Stick those on your yogurt bowl or your porridge. You don't need the goji berries.
So combined with this love of food was your love of science as a kid. And at this stage, I think it was around sort of 2012, you were already thinking about moving into the field of nutrition. Would that be right?
So my journey into nutrition was not textbook. I didn't wake up as a teenager thinking, I know the degree that I wanted to do. And it's really funny, actually, as a nutritionist, the one degree I never thought I'd study was nutrition. I looked down on it, I'm going to be really honest. And I went to a very pressured, very academic school. I did something called the International Baccalaureate, which was like an intense version of A-levels. And I almost felt proud of myself for being so academic. And I loved chemistry and I loved biology. I didn't know if I wanted to go into research, something to do with the human body. And I was like, this is cool. And It was when I was about 17 years old that I went to a music festival and I got a tap on the shoulder. And it was an in-house modeling team from ASOS. And they said, would you like to come in for a test shoot? At that time, 17, ASOS in its absolute heyday, I pretty much shopped on there every single week. I was like, absolutely. And I ended up falling into the fashion industry, like totally unawares. And still, again, someone who was very much into science. But I went into the fashion industry for a period of about 2 or 3 years. And suddenly, going from a teenager from a very free family, my mum never dieted, my granny never dieted, my mum never really brought trashy magazines either, so I wasn't really exposed to a lot of health noise. I suddenly started getting my lunch critiqued. So if I had a panini, someone would comment being like, I can't believe you eat those, like with the cheese and the carbs. And then I suddenly got an agency and they started critiquing my body and my face and my weight. And there was one moment that I came back and it was the first time I'd ever been told to lose weight. Mm. And they looked at my thighs and they said, do you know what? We think you'll book more jobs if you slim down your thighs. And I don't know why. And people and you can ask me, oh, why do you think it was such a trigger for you? But it was like a switch went off in my brain that the same person who wanted to try and achieve the best, people please, seek validation. I said, okay, cool. I'm going to do the best job at slimming down as possible. So what did I do? I turned to Google. Mm-hmm. And the information that I was fed as that vulnerable teenage girl shook me into a full-blown eating disorder pretty much overnight. And it developed and it got worse and worse until I started to lose a scary amount of weight. My family would notice. My friends would notice. I wouldn't eat with my family anymore. I wouldn't sit around the dinner table and allow my mum to cook for me. I didn't eat out, I didn't do any of it. And it stole so much of the joy and the purpose of my family's and my life because we lived for food, we lived to eat. And I remember the day that my mum put down a cheese roll in front of me, and it's a cheese roll, and she made them all for the family. It was the first time she'd made me something in about 8 months. She said, here, Emily, I made you lunch. And I had a mental breakdown because I knew I couldn't eat it, could not physically eat this cheese roll. So I was like, what is wrong with me? This is not how I want to live my life. So I ended up seeing the most amazing therapist. She helped pull me out of this thinking pattern and this prison that I put myself in. And at that point, I knew that the fashion industry was not for me. I left, I went to university finally, and I studied nutrition. And isn't that crazy now that if that experience had never happened to me, I would have never been a nutritionist.
I mean, there's a few things I want to pull from that. First of all, I mean, we were talking about validation and the need to people please and how it can actually have a negative impact when it's not applied in a beneficial form to ourselves, needing validation from the modeling industries, probably the road to ruin.
I think it's the types of validation that I recognize now that are not good for you. Mm. And I think even, like, I'm in the space of social media, so there's a lot of validation that I would get from my engagement, my views, how many likes you get, and all of these things can actually be quite soul-destroying and quite triggering and put you in a vulnerable place. And it reminds me of the same validation that I sought when I was in that fashion industry. Like, am I pretty enough? Are these photos good enough? Do I look tall enough? Do I look skinny enough? And all of these things, I think, like, ends up kind of becoming a little bit obsessive. I now always try and recognize the moments that I know that those validation triggers are not coming from a good place. Mm. And there, of course, is playing a game around us. I'm bringing it back, but you hit an amazing bat and you make the whole way around. That feeling of validation when everyone cheers you and like, that's amazing, that's good, that's soul fulfilling. But trying to seek validation for your worth from things that do not determine your worth, I think is what you have to be so careful around.
You went to therapy. Was it CBT?
It was.
How tough was it to undo that mindset that you'd been placed in?
Joe, it was tough, but my therapist actually suffered from an eating disorder in her life as well. And I instantly felt like someone understood and they could connect with me. And I think this is the biggest thing. Like, if someone hasn't had any issues with their relationships with food, it's very hard to understand. So my mum, for example, could not understand why I could not eat the cheese roll, because she came from such a normal, healthy relationship with food. She was like, oh, it's just food, why can't you just eat it? But eating disorders are this crazy spectrum of relationships and behaviors, and they can vary through kind of OCD, obsession, comfort, validation, and all these things. So finding the right therapist was the game-changing thing for me. So a therapist that I felt understood me. And she'd often say, imagine if you were watching you through the TV screen. Imagine if what's going on in your life right now is being aired. And you tune in, how would you feel? What would you say to the character on screen? And that's a tool. And I use a lot of the CBT tools that I learned from Jane now every single day in my life, because they are so beneficial. Sometimes all we need is a little bit of perspective. And the things that stress us out, we take that bird's eye view, you come out and you're like, do you know what? It's not that bad.
I like the analogy of being able to talk to yourself on a TV show. It works because that really isn't you. It's an aspect of you that you want to communicate with.
And we get sometimes, like, we keep on digging a hole, and we'll dig and we'll dig and we'll dig, and we get so obsessed with digging the hole that we're suddenly realizing, like, what we're digging the hole for. And it's like those moments that you watch, like, characters on TV screens, and you're sitting there and you're being like, what are you doing? Don't go in the room. Don't open the door. Like in the horror movies. And it's those moments in your life that sometimes we have to just, like, watch yourself.
I mean, it's obviously, it's not news that we live in an era where people are constantly comparing themselves to others on Instagram. And, you know, what you do is quite a saturated market. I mean, obviously, you've risen to the peak of being a food influencer, if you will. Would that be a fair description?
I actually hate the word influencer.
Yeah, I thought you might. Sorry. Yeah. No, it's fine. How would you like it described?
Do you know, it's a really hard one, because I would call myself a cook and I would call myself a nutritionist. Okay. So what's the hybrid between that word?
Well, as an online cook and nutritionist, cooktritionist.
New cook.
A cook, like that sounds like almost like yeah.
Hybrid.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, I'm still going to go with a cooktritionist because, you know, copyright. You came up with Nicook. So, as an online personality who specialises in nutrition and culinary delights, if you will, you've risen to the top of that field. But were you at one stage comparing yourself to what others were doing and sort of going, why is their video growing more than mine? Why are they more popular? Was that something that either motivated you or had a negative impact on trying to grow your own identity?
Such a good question. And the person who's been amazing for me for this is actually my husband. And my husband is in marketing strategy. And when we first met, I had such a clear idea of who I was in the nutrition space. Like, I really did. I was the food you want to eat designed by a nutritionist. And we carved that strategy out from pretty much day one. And every single time I'd show him a video, I'd be like, oh, I love this. Oh, I feel like maybe I should be doing this. Or this is trending. He said, no, stick to the strategy. And if anyone's trying to build a brand and they believe in the brand that they're building. So I think that's number one, the most important thing. You have to back yourself. If you do not believe in your idea and your vision, no one else is going to. But also believe in the fact that we are never alone in this world. So if we have an idea or a belief of how something should be done or changing the way that something's done, I guarantee there'll be a community out there who feel the same for you. And in this life, I honestly think it's about us kind of going through and finding the people who resonate with our own values and our own beliefs. So I stuck to the strategy, and every single time I maybe like started to compare myself, my husband would be like, stick to the strategy. And it served me so well, because I've now found a community of over 2 million people who also love the food you want to eat designed by a nutritionist.
It is time to raise a glass to our sponsor, Laurent Perrier, who has added a touch of sparkle to my conversation with Emily. As ever, we are sampling their latest release, the Laurent Perrier Heritage, which is more than just a tasteful champagne. In many ways, it's a taste of history. Laurent Perrier was the first house in Champagne to start using stainless steel vats. By controlling fermentation at cool temperatures, they could preserve the wine's freshness and unlock complex aromas. This pioneering approach became central to the way Laurent Perrier conserves its reserve wines. Heritage is made exclusively from reserve wines kept in stainless steel tanks, reflecting the house's savoir-faire in the conservation and management of these wines. It is a complex blend of several vintages from the finest cru of Champagne, uniting Chardonnay and Pinot Noir to achieve remarkable balance. Selected for their freshness, elegance, and complexity, these reserve wines give Heritage its unique taste profile. So here's to Laurent Perrier Heritage, where freshness, elegance, and purity come together perfectly. Cheers. I want to ask something that we ask every guest, because as we sit here now, as we've established, a hugely successful cook and nutritionist, a cooktritionist. We're going to discuss that more in a bit. But my question is, if you had to really nail it down, why do you think you have succeeded where so many have not?
Because I saw the space and I knew I could fill it. When I turned to Google that day, I imagine if I found me on Instagram when I was that young, vulnerable girl who'd just been told to slim down her thighs. Imagine if I found me. What message would I want to portray? What confidence would I want to give little M to be able to still eat dinner with her family and give permission to, okay, we can explore health, we can explore nutrition and confidence and eating to support your hormones and your sleep and your vibrancy and your life, but never taking away any of that joy. Mm. I think so much of it is just seeing that space and having the confidence to fill it. And I knew I could fill it. And every single day from that moment, I've worked my ass off to make sure that I'm filling that space and giving my wonderful community what they need and what they want.
And are you conscious of how? I mean, obviously, the information you're delivering is wonderful and useful, and your followers love it. Do you have to consider how you're delivering that information? Because, I mean, it can be very easy. Sometimes I'm like, I feel like I'm being preached at when I look at some people and the way they're talking to me. It's like, you do have a no-nonsense style. Is that cultivated, like, in a very conscious way?
Definitely. And it's food first. It's recipe first. We don't need nutrients to eat food. And so often the reason why nutrition feels so inaccessible is because we're taught it in a way that's like learning food out of a book, but never stepping into a kitchen. And another analogy that I use, it's like teaching a football team how to play football, but getting them only to play FIFA. You need to be on the pitch playing with people, against people, to properly understand it and for it to feel natural. So in order for people to learn nutrition, you need to be in the kitchen, cooking, testing, experimenting, living with nutrition in your life. And the one thing that shocked me so much when I went to university is, I'm going to say most nutritionists can't cook. And isn't that so funny? You're trying to teach people something that essentially you're exposed to every single day, because we all eat every single day. Yeah. So my content is food first, normal food, accessible food, food that you can go and pick up from your local express shop, actually cook in 15 minutes and know that your fussy husband's going to like it and your kids are going to like it. And even like your baby, you can wean them on it because it fits into life. And that's what nutrition is for. Nutrition is for life.
We're going to talk about studying nutrition at King's College. Obviously, that's not far. We're about 40 minutes from where you grew up in Bedford. Was that a conscious decision to stay quite close to home? Because a lot of students obviously try and move as far away from home to get the full student experience. But
funnily enough, my parents visited me twice during my whole degree.
Okay.
When they dropped me off and when they moved myself out.
So you were in halls then?
Yeah, I was.
Full experience.
Yeah, okay. Halls the first year. I went to King's because it was the best university in the UK for nutrition at the time. And I was very lucky to work with some incredible professors. A lot of the professors, even now, are still doing incredible research around gut health. A few of them got involved with, like, Zoe. And I did love it. Very excitingly, I've been invited to go back and do the graduation and the guest of honour for the Faculty Amazing. Of Life Science and Medicine this year to do the talk. And I've been writing my speech and thinking, what would I want these people to kind of take away and learn? And it's, even though sometimes you feel you're exposed to someone who knows more than you, don't be afraid to challenge things if you believe that things could be done better. And even now I look back at that degree and going to one of the most prestigious universities, I still think it's taught slightly wrong. And
is that going in the speech?
in a way. But it's one thing that we're even working on now. Like my team, we want to go into schools and start looking at nutrition curriculum and food technology. Because quite frankly, I think it's all well and good having so much scientific information about something that is incredibly scientific, like nutrition. When you get into the nutritional science side of things, it's fascinating. But if we really want to make a change to people's health and we look at the state of people's health in the UK, there's a privilege divide, A, which means the rich are probably getting healthier and then the poor are still consuming high amounts of ultra-processed foods and their health is deteriorating. How do we make sure that this nutritional science and this nutritional gap is achievable for everyone? And I still don't think that they're teeing us up right for that.
I'm glad you mentioned King's College does have what is regarded as one of the great nutrition degrees in this country. Now, I'll admit, I wrongly assumed this had been a recent addition to the university's prospectus of degrees, because you sort of think, oh, because nutrition has now become such a big part of our lives, they've added nutrition. 1945 is when that degree was first created. And I mean, so that degree has been there through the rise of processed food, industrial scale farming. I imagine it's been there gnashing its teeth and going, what are people doing? What did it offer you in terms of supercharging your passion and giving you real, I guess, direction for when you stepped out the door after 3 years?
It's hard because a lot of nutrition isn't sexy. There are certain parts of health that we get exposed to a lot, and these are the clickbaity, sexy, headline-y things. A lot of the more fundamental sides of nutrition, it's like Magnolia wallpaper. Like, people don't want to buy it. They're like, oh, that's the cop-out. And I think what my degree did was give me this really solid foundation of, okay, this is how we fuel the body. This is what the body needs. These are some really exciting areas of our health and well-being. I mean, gut health is actually super cool. Like, it's actually amazing. And there were parts of it that definitely kind of like unlocked a few ideas in my mind. But the thing that still excited me the most was food and writing recipes and meal plans for people who would come to me as a nutritionist after I graduated. And I was like, cool, how do I tackle this situation? And I think the biggest issue still is a lot of the nutrition space, it can never be hyper-personalized. Or it just has this kind of one size fits all. Like, I mean, how long has the NHS Eat Well Plate been slapped around schools? How long have we just been told, oh, five a day, 1 in 5 a day? We just have this nutrition messaging that we just get so heavily exposed to. It then goes in one ear and out the other. People don't really know what to do with it. So I think a lot of the issues is that we have all this messaging that we kind of then get fed through these kind of very old school NHS protocols, that they are outdated and they're not really accessible and they're not really achievable and people don't know what to do with them.
I'd like to fill in the blank, if you will, between leaving university with your degree and becoming the Emily English who is sitting here now at the Savoy, because you started your own nutrition practice, a private practice, after uni. But then it's one of my favourite inventions of the last decade, Deliveroo, helped out in some way. And I'm trying to just sort of understand, how did they approach you? What is the story there? Because lockdown had happened at this point.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did not graduate university being like, wow, I know exactly what I want to do, set up my business. I just want to make that clear. So I graduated university. I even worked in guest relations in a restaurant for a bit.
Okay.
So I did quite a few random jobs. But I mean, hospitality's always had my heart and I've always felt comfortable in there because I couldn't get just a great job in nutrition that I wanted to do. And I think that's a really sad place that a lot of graduates would leave and they can't instantly just jump into something that they feel is going to fulfill them, but that's just part of life. Sometimes we just take the opportunities that we get. So I did a bit of hospitality, then I went into a DNA genetic testing company who were on the high street, who would swab you in store and we'd process the DNA, we'd we'd work out these new markers and give you a personalised meal plan. But the biggest issue was...
Does that work? I'm sketchy about whether that's actually a thing.
With anything about personalised nutrition, all they tell you to do is eat more vegetables and move more. And you end up paying.
Like, how much was that?
It's even with Zoe. Like, it's just, you're just telling people to like eat more whole foods, less processed foods, watch your sugar intake, and... they charge you £300 for it, so I could have told you that for free. So yeah, I went into there, and then I was like, okay, like, I'm not happy here. I know that I'm ready to do my own thing. So then I set up my clinic. COVID happened. The clinic was great, so I could do it virtually, still build my client base. And then I got approached by a couple of guys who, during this time, something called dark kitchens was really popular. So when a restaurant or a pub used to close, they used to rent out their kitchen facilities to takeaway companies, delivery companies. So the guy was like, look, have you thought about doing like a health delivery company? I was like, okay, fine. Like, I can cook, like I feel confident in it. I have been around kitchens and hospitality. So I set it up, and it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I was like up at 4 a.m. and I'd get back at 8 p.m. 7 days a week, and I just drove myself into the ground with it. But it started to do really well. I used to do healthy breakfast muffins, like a McDonald's McMuffin, but with like chicken sausages and fresh tomatoes. I used to do these massive salad bowls, and they were called like the Thrive Bowl with like Romesco grilled chicken, 10-stem broccoli. I had the Glow Bowl with like salmon, potato salad, like pickled cucumber.
And this was I could have ordered this on delivery. What was it called?
It was called the Nutritionist Table.
The Nutritionist Table. And you were doing this on your own, or you?
Pretty much single-handedly. Yeah. Unfortunately, I just couldn't find the right staff, and ended up having a little bit of disagreement with my business partners. They got me at a time when I think I had about 1,000 followers, and my husband was there, my now husband was there being like, oh, you need to get behind the camera, like, because you're so great and you need to be the face of this brand. And I remember turning around to my business partners and they said, no one cares about what you have to say. Like, no one cares about you. And
that's something.
And then it got to a crescendo point that I realized it was unsustainable, because I couldn't get the staff. I could not keep on doing 7 days a week the hours that I was doing. My nutrition business was suffering because that pretty much like all got put to one side. I was trying to juggle my clients around it. And I ended up leaving it. But around at the same time, I started to kind of M the Nutritionist, and I started making videos on M the Nutritionist's account. And remember the first video I ever did, I opened the kitchen cupboard of our kitchen, of the flat we were renting, and I put my phone on the shelf and it looked down on the chopping board. And I made, I think it's like a courgette prawn salad. And I look back, you can scroll back, and it's hilarious. Did the editing myself for the first time ever, did my little voiceover, and I think it took me about 3 hours to do a 30-second voiceover because I just couldn't get it right. And I uploaded it. And I started doing these videos and sharing, and these were recipes that I would often already have given to clients. So I would have done like a client meal plan that week and blah, it's a nice recipe, I may as well film this one. And it was often food that I would eat as well. So I would come back from a busy day or be a bit tired or want to make a nice breakfast, and I put it together in a way that I liked. And it just so turns out that other people liked it too. So I'd keep on sharing these videos, and I'd try and constantly improve and upgrade. And I'd get a studio light, I'd get a new chopping board, I'd try and get some new bowls and plates, and I'd clean up my editing, and I'd work out that, oh, it works quite well when the split time is like a second per thing. I'd work out hooks and engagement. And it suddenly started to grow exponentially. And I remember a distinctive moment where I did this ultimate Greek salad with a olive oil, like garlic, parsley kind of toast that I'd like rubbed, and it was gorgeous. And that was almost like a giant crouton. And it's the first reel that ever hit 20,000 views.
Why do you think that was? Was it just a gradual increase, or was there something about that reel that you can look back and go, ah?
Good question. And I think it's one of the reasons why I still do quite well with my engagement, is that I'm responsive to what people are going through. What's the temperature of the day? Is it payday? Is it a Sunday or is it a Friday? When you share content, often you have to actually be aware that people don't really want to eat a soup in 30 degree heat. And I remember it was the heat wave. So it was just one of those gorgeous salads that people were like, oh, they'd come up on their feet, be like, oh God, I fancy that. And it's the same way I think chefs design menus. You know, when you go to a restaurant, you're like, oh God, I could eat everything on this. And you look at some of the most successful restaurateurs in London, it's because they feed people what they want. And I think my videos and the certain videos that do so well is because they feed people in the moments that they look at it and they're like, oh, smash that.
The Nutritionist table, did you leave that brand behind and give it to your business partners and go, I'm done with that, and set up M the Nutritionist at that point? Or
I own the trademark.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Good.
And it's a business idea that is sitting bubbling lovingly, and I will reactivate it someday soon.
Good work. Right, we're about to catch up on ourselves even more into the here and now, but I want to ask you something we ask all our guests, because like I said, and as you've explained, you've created a hugely successful business followed by millions. You've released two best-selling books, built your brand from scratch to huge success in just 5 years in what is a saturated market. With all the experience and knowledge you now have, what do you think it takes to be original?
Being original is seeing things other people don't see. Even now, like, people have built whole Instagram profiles off my concept, and you'll see them literally like a copy and paste version of me. And if people do say, oh, imitation's the form of flattery, and sometimes I'm not flattered by this point. Like, it's...
But how do you feel? Does it annoy you? Does it get, or is it just like, well, of course people are going to do that and there's nothing I can do about it? Do you just put it to one side?
Depends how badly they rip me off. If it's literally like my recipe, yeah. I'm just like, guys, come on, like, try and be original. But it's hard because I definitely do feel like I've always been the person who's seen things differently. Even when I was at school, I would struggle to sit through a lesson with a teacher that I didn't like, because I didn't like how they were teaching it. And I knew that I could learn it better in a way that suited me. Mm. And I was comfortable with that. And I'd actually often skip and Skype these lessons, but I'd go home, but I'd do it myself. And I would study and I would get great grades just because I knew that that wasn't for me. So originality comes through that space of actually probably being a bit naughty. But like naughty in a sense of you're not hurting anyone, or you're not going to be upsetting anyone or putting anyone down, but it's like, be a bit cheeky, be a bit naughty, be a bit daring, and don't be afraid to do the thing that you believe in, because you know that it's actually better than what's going on right now.
And you mentioned Aaron, your husband. Mm-hmm. When you are so sort of fiercely independent and very much self-reliant, and then you sort of like let someone into that space, was that an easy thing to do? Or was it like, look, I know what I'm doing, I got this? Did he, I don't want to say have to prove himself, but was there a moment where you're like, do I trust this person's idea to put myself in the videos, or do I know a better way?
Aaron is the love of my life. And I met him and it's like, I've known this person. Like, this person was put on this earth for me. And it's so funny that you say that, because he's the only person that I will be vulnerable for and let take care of me and feel and soften and relax for. And he's the only person that, like, when I first met him, he just brought out every single best bit of me. And I think that's why I just knew. I feel so lucky, because I didn't believe that type of love existed. And he proved me wrong in every sense. And he is my best friend. He is my cheerleader. Even now, sometimes he's so opposite to me. And sometimes, of course, he does annoy me that he's like, oh, let's go through this lovely, windy, wandery route. I'm like, no, let's just go from A to B. Like, why are we going to add 5 minutes on our journey to like go through these streets? But I love that about him. And even now, like, I'm incredibly disciplined. I'm incredibly like focused and hardworking, and I love it. And I love my job, and I love being ambitious. But then I also love the silly, stupid side of me that he makes sure still exists, and then he brings out.
It's an interesting turn of phrase you use there. Like, I didn't believe that kind of love existed. I sometimes think that, you know, when you are quite independent and very work orientated and very focused on what you want to do, it does take something or someone very special to actually break through that armor, if you will, and actually make anyone go, wow, I genuinely hadn't expected that to happen.
Yeah. Like, we met literally during full COVID lockdown, and our first day was classic, a walk. and we walked for hours, and we ended up getting a bottle of takeaway Pinot Noir from Marks and Spencer's and two plastic wine glasses. And it was like January, and it was freezing. We sat on the Thames, and I had to leave because there was no public bathrooms open, and I was so desperate for a wee. And I'd held it honestly for an hour because I didn't want to leave this day. And I'm like, I'm really sorry, I have to go, I have to wee. And I moved in on day two.
Wow.
And we've lived together ever since. Now we're married and we're just about to move into our first home together that all of this has built. And that's such an incredible moment for me, because it gets coming from a situation. I think sometimes people have this perception, they look at me and they think maybe I'm a bit silver spoon fed and I've just always been given everything in my life. It's like, no, every single thing that I do and I have, I've worked for. And I worked really hard for, and I'm really proud of myself for working for. And I'm still proud of the fact that, like, my love for my family is huge. And my love for my parents, and we all get together now, and it's phenomenal. We still love to connect around food, and Chef Granny is still an icon. With her crazy, massive, curly hair, and she'll walk in with, like, a banoffee pie when it's a birthday, and it's just, like, mega, it's so good. And, yeah, it's funny because all the things that went wrong in my life have been the things that I needed to become the person that I dreamed of being.
To go back to the example you used earlier, when you Googled during your time as a model, how to lose weight quickly, and it came up with awful, unregulated, toxic diets. If you Googled that today, do you think the result would be different? Because it was, what, 2014 when you Googled that? Do you think here in 2025, if someone Googled how to lose weight quickly, they would get a more positive answer?
I mean, it's still a washing machine of opinions. And I honestly can say that the health industry and nutrition space is probably one of the most opinionated spaces out there, one of the most conflicting. How can you even work out what's right and wrong? Rise of Ozempic as well. So I think Ozempic will obviously probably be the hot topic that would come up in that sense. But it just takes everything that I love away from food. And I just don't believe that good health should ever come at the compromise of your happiness. And this is what I try and tell people, and I try and show people. It's like, no, you can have it all. You can have all the things that you love in moderation, of course. Like, we're not going to be like, I was speaking to a journalist the other day and we were talking about sweets and stuff, and she was like, oh yeah, but cake's full of like refined sugar. I'm like, yeah, but you're not eating the whole cake. And it's like, what are you going to do, like have an avocado mousse for your birthday? No, like just have the slice of cake. So it's these things, and it's these reassurances, and it's the fact that people get so obsessed, and the DMs that I get of people worrying about the tiny minuscule details when they're not thinking about the bigger picture of their life. And I also say a great visualization tool is, imagine every single thing that you eat over the course of a year being laid out on a table. What percentage of that do you want to have all the healthy, nourishing, delicious foods? So veggies, your water, your fiber, your proteins, whole grains, all those good things.
I think you said you'd like to be the female Jamie Oliver, in so much as you mentioned going into schools, educating kids at a young age about, you know, how to eat healthy, how to, you know, how a diet can be fun. Food can be fun, but still good for you. Jamie Oliver obviously has restaurants. Could we see an Emily English restaurant in the future? I mean, you've got the Nutrition Kitchen brand name still in your pocket.
I do. Do you know what? I just know how hard it is to run restaurants. And people should be supporting their locals, their restaurants more and more, because they are probably the industry that's struggling the most at the moment. And for that reason, the idea of probably opening one isn't amazing. But I do speak with my husband, and our retirement plan, like if we did come to retire, I would love to have my own little space, and I'd open it at like really obnoxious hours, like maybe like a Wednesday and Thursday only, because I'm off on the weekends, or I'll just open it on the weekends and I'll be on the dining table next to you with a glass of wine. But I love the idea of being able to feed more people. So whether that be in restaurant form, whether that be in like a Joe and the Juice concept form, something like that. But I've held on to that name because I know I want to do something with it, just not sure what yet.
We've made our way through a tiny portion of your achievements today. But what is it in your career that you are most proud of?
being invited back to my university to do my Faculty of Life Science and Medicine graduation speech. It's like my Steve Jobs moment. And I've been honestly practicing the speech for so many weeks now. And that for me is the 360 moment. I'm like, wow, I really have achieved something here, haven't I?
That's great. That's great. Are you going to film it? Are you going to put it online? Are we going to be able to watch it? Or is it just in the moment?
I think we can watch it online. I'm going to try and get the footage. And I've got my little hat and my little cape again.
So. Brilliant. Okay, tell me the most valuable skill you've ever learnt. The one that changed the way you do things.
Clean as you go. So when you're cooking and you feel like things get on top of you, clean as you go. Have the little bin bowl. You feel like your life and your house gets on top of you, just clean as you go. It will change everything.
Fair. I find cleaning so therapeutic as well. But I sometimes wonder if I'm using it as a distraction rather than sitting with the thoughts.
Procrastination, yeah.
Now, finally, can you give us one piece of advice that you'd give to someone else wanting to follow in your footsteps? Because I think, as we've seen, you didn't have a leg up into this industry. I think you've opened doors probably for a lot of people who didn't think they might be able to do what you've done. But what would be your piece of advice to those people?
Content that doesn't perform is content that is not resonating with the right people. And I often say content creation isn't a vanity project. You have to make sure that you're offering people value and you're giving people something that would want to make them say, oh, that's a good idea. Oh, I want to save that. So if you're struggling with the content creation space, you don't feel like you're getting the engagement and the reach that you deserve, truly take a look like you would with a business and you have an appraisal where you'll have a look at everything that you're doing and think, could I do this better? Why did that fly and that didn't fly? And try and actually look for the patterns and what resonates with people, because so often we blame things like algorithms, whereas we're not properly looking and critiquing at our own kind of content output. So don't be afraid to be a little bit harder on yourself, because if you're a little bit harder with yourself, pressure makes diamonds and you'll really start to create something special.
Emily English, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, that was a better clink than the first one. And that is it. Thank you to our producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Laurent Perrier, and of course to Emily English for coming in today. Join me again next week when we'll be opening the Savoy's Little Black Book to welcome another celebrated guest and ask them what it takes to be a true original. Until then, follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.